Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Sawtooth Mountains, my secret studio, comes LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I am looking directly at my co-host from Albuquerque, New Mexico, the quirky, lovely, charming Bobby Jean Bell. Her royal quirkiness, as Richard said. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, we're counting down to Balloon Fiesta here in Albuquerque. It's like one day and a few hours left before it lifts off, I guess.
Oh, my gosh. And, of course, sitting back in the chair where he belongs.
Yay.
Is number three on the roster, Mr. Richard Polinelli. Welcome home, Richard.
Hey, I am very happy to be back, and I want to say thank you to everybody here on the show and listening and elsewhere who reached out over the last couple of weeks. Really appreciate that, guys. Can't really say how much I do, but
we missed you. And we truly thought about taking up a collection, but nah.
But maybe get 4 pennies and a ball of lint or something.
Well, actually, I have 3 nickels on my desk that I got from some guy in Missoula. I don't know who he is.
Just a lot of the people who reached out. Thank you, guys. I will spend the rest of my life trying to thank everybody personally. So I just do it here instead.
Well, good luck with that. A lot of them didn't even know you.
Yeah.
But we are so happy to have you back. And, of course, you are going out live tonight to well over 5 people, at least that I know of. We could add a bunch of zeros to that. But,
yeah,
this, of course, is live radio. So anything you hear happens as it happens. And there's no going back and fixing it. So if it happens, and we have had them, we have had some doozies. But we're glad to have you back, Rich. And of course, Bobby Jean, it's always a pleasure to have you on the air with us because you are one radio chick. You are on the air a lot.
Because I just love it so much.
And for almost 7 years, you've been my partner in crime. And let's make it another 7.
Yeah, sounds good. I'm up for it.
Okay. Let's get right into this book tonight because this writer is a terrific gal. I've spoken to her this week. She's just, full of life, she is just like a conversationalist from hell. She actually can talk in real sentences, you know? So, and that makes it a lot more fun to talk to a writer when they actually can refer back to you and say, hey, yeah, I did that, or I didn't do that. She is, of course, has written a book called Kids and Cocktails Don't Mix. And it is about her childhood growing up in Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s and the things that happened to her as a child, which we will get into. And she's married to H.R. Haldeman's oldest son, Hank. So it is we welcome with no trepidation whatsoever. We welcome to the Writer's Block her first visit and certainly not her last. Please welcome Heather Haldeman. Hi, Heather.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's so much of a pleasure. It's our pleasure, actually.
Mine as well.
I absolutely loved your book. It was it brought back so many memories of Los Angeles to me, growing up in Southern California in Del Mar, and my grandparents lived in Clifton Street in East LA, right overlooking the city, actually.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And this whole thing was, I mean, you mentioned places we all were when we were kids and adults, and areas that, I'm from, North San Diego County. We were all over San Diego and North County and Del Mar and Encinitas and Leucadia and, every place around there. So we got to go Huntington Beach. We got to go to Newport. We got to go, we went everywhere. And so, these are all places you mentioned in your book, not always in a good way. well, it's because there's a lot of chagrin that happened. And I let's start mm-hmm. off with you, being 10, 11. At the very beginning of your book here, I believe 11 years old or 10, is it?
I was 8, actually.
Oh, okay. 8. Wow.
And but I did things move quickly.
Yeah. Apparently. kind of give us a synopsis of how things were with your life at 8 years old.
Well, at that point in time, we had just moved to Fremont Place, and we'd lived on Longwood, which was not far from there, but my father he was a big spender and a high roller and thought, well, I can do better than this. And so he bought a home in Fremont Place. And at the time, he was a lawyer, an attorney, and he had many famous clients, Hollywood types, Jack Webb, Jack Lemmon. They really ran with quite a crowd. And let me just preface, Fremont Place is in an area of Los Angeles called Hancock Park, which is the center of the city, basically. And Fremont Place was its own little enclave, just a private gated community, one of the first in Los Angeles, that was behind gates. And the book starts out where my mother and father are giving a party in their living room. And it really, basically, I wanted to set the stage with the characters and who they all were, kind of introduce them. And you get a feeling of just, it's really a parent's world. I mean, the children were seen and not heard, but that, hence the title of the book, Kids and Cocktails Don't Mix. At the end of the parties my parents would have, we'd come down in our nightgowns and say hello to the guests and then be shuffled upstairs. And that was the end of that. So that I start out with that. And then as I gradually tell the story of my parents and what happened with them, and the story just keeps moving forward from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, and suffice to say, it was not a very happy childhood after that.
No. And it's interesting because when I started the book, I thought it was going to be the story of the house. I thought, okay, mm-hmm. we're going to write. My mother lived there 30 years and we'll all just write about the house. And then it turned into a story. I thought, well, then it's really going to be about my mother, because no one gets a character like this. No writer could make her up. Yeah. And she was quite something and larger than life. But then as I really got into writing the book, I realized it was my story and through my eyes. And as I wrote it, I kept thinking, really, who is going to care? I'm not famous. I didn't have terrible, child abuse or many, many challenging things that many, many children have gone through. But it was very difficult and very, it's funny. I didn't think it was so awful as I went through it. But when I go back, I realize, yes, it was very painful, very, very painful.
Yeah.
And it really tells the story, I guess, of resilience as well, both my mother's and mine. and that, you know, what I dedicated the book to is children of divorce, that, you know, if that, that who feel fat, dumb, or ugly, that I see them. And I do, I was that child. I was fat, I was dumb, and I wasn't particularly attractive. And my sister was, I had one sister, and she was absolutely drop dead gorgeous. And my mother was very image oriented, as was my father. So we're starting with that already. And it was difficult. It was challenging. And I just ate my way into ate my way into soothing myself. And, you know, it was difficult. You know, my parents were unhappily married, and it was, you know, the fights and all the things that a child sees growing up, it really affects you. And then, of course, they divorce, and then the book progresses into the next period in my mother's life that we all went along with the ride. And it just keeps moving, you know, forward. And I, the other night, Jim, when we spoke, you had said, this must have been cathartic writing this book. And I think about that. A lot of people ask me that. And really, it was so strange to write it. When my editor and mentor kept saying, you got to go deeper, you've got to go deeper. And I kept saying, but I am so deep. I'm already deep enough. I don't need to go any deeper. And then I realized, as I did go deeper, I almost became a character in my book. It was as if I was separating myself. And perhaps I did that for myself, but, you know, it helped me actually even go deeper and really be in the moment and see and feel what was going on and the scenes, setting the scenes. And once I set the scene, I could go there.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing this, it had to have been, as you were writing and you had to go deeper into it, and you would set your scene and you would go deep, deep, deep. And then did you remember things that you heretofore had not remembered before?
Well, yes, in a way, certain things, feelings, like, for example, as we were sitting at the dinner table at Perino's in Los Angeles, a very high-end restaurant back in the day. It was very beautiful and very in the neighborhood of Hancock Park. And there's a scene where I'm reaching for the Parmesan cheese toast, which was one of their famous things they were noted for. And I remember my mother, you know, I knew, because she'd be so interested in keeping my father happy, that she wouldn't be angry that I was eating more, because she always wanted me to not eat. You're getting fatter, you're getting fatter. So I remember when I was writing it, I remembered the feeling of sneaking and getting away with it. It's like as you're, you know, typing the words, you can feel it. You go, oh, yes, I remember that. I felt that.
Yes. And now you also just said a few minutes ago that you don't feel that you were ever, it was not child abuse. But I think nowadays, now I hate that phrase nowadays, but I'll use it because I have no other phrase. but now I think they would consider what you went through child abuse, certainly what your father
did. Definitely. My gosh.
Not so much your mother. Your mother really didn't have any other way. Your father certainly had decisions and choices to make and opted not to go there. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Neglect, you know, pure neglect.
Which, you know, today they put up a jail.
Yes, you're right. No, I wasn't beaten, but I was completely neglected. And I think, you know, that as the reader will see, what happens to my sister and me, what my father does to us, and now that I'm an adult with my own children, when my children were little, even now, anytime, I thought, how can a parent do that? How could any parent do what he did? It's unbelievable to me. And I could never forgive him. Never. Never.
Well, obviously, because you didn't. No. Your sister, I think, had it a little easier because she was able to escape. She had her friends and her music and whatever, you know, she was gone. So she got away from it. You kind of stuck there.
Exactly, Jim. That's a really good point because she had distractions. And yes, definitely.
Yeah, I just want to know one thing, and then I'm going to turn it over to Richard or Bobby. Who got the Mustang?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the important question right there.
You're so cute.
With the side mirror that fells off.
Well, I'll tell you this quick story. My mother on her third husband, Doogie, and I'm not sure if this is in the book or not. I've written it in a blog for sure, but the car was literally on its last legs, and she had gone on a date, her first date with Doogie, Alan McDougall, my second stepfather, Alan too, my mother used to call him, and that he was leaving, and my mother was getting in her car, and he was getting in his, and he leaned on the side mirror of the Mustang, and it came off in his hand.
And snapped it off, yeah.
And it's in the book.
It's in the book.
Okay. And that did it. That did it. And he just, it was it. And so I don't recall what happened to it in the end. I don't remember. I know he bought her a BMW convertible. It was like, oh my gosh.
Well,
she was so sexy.
For years and years and years, for 35 years, that was my business, was classic muscle cars. And Mustangs, even though falling apart with no wheels on them, they're worth a ton of money. So that's why I'm kind of curious who got the car.
Well, I didn't. I'll tell you that.
If it's still
right
in
now.
Your garage,
and
I want
nor did
it.
April. Oh, gosh, you're cute.
We'll start a bidding war. If it's what year was that Mustang? I'm
66, wasn't it?
A 66. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. With the steering wheel with
it was 12 years old.
It had pony interior and everything. It was really a nice car. At the time.
Yes.
Yeah, because I think it's 12 years old. I think she says to him when it's paid for. You write it. It's 12 years old, and she says, and it's paid for.
Well, see, if it had been a 64 and a half, I'd go steal it. So, I mean, I'm just saying.
I love that you brought up the Mustang. I think that's great.
Well, that's the first thing I thought. Wait, your mother drove a Mustang. I thought, okay. At the time, that was a pretty hot car. And then, of course, you keep saying your mother was a pretty hot chick. So,
mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, my husband says that she was a cross between Carol Channing and Phyllis Diller, who thinks she's Marilyn Monroe.
I got it. Yeah.
Really, oh, my God. How funny.
Yeah.
You mentioned so many places in this book. Richard's been there. I've been there. Bobby's been to some of them. It's just amazing that brings back old Los Angeles. And that's one of the reasons that I think I enjoyed your book so much. I hated seeing you suffer the way you did, but you brought up so many places that are reminiscent of when I was growing up, because we're in the same generation. Mm-hmm. We're all baby boomers. You talk about, oh my gosh, the restaurants and that my grandma took me to. The only place you didn't mention was Grumman's Chinese, and I'm surprised.
Oh, yeah, gosh, nothing happened there. Well, nothing happened to me there, pardon that. That's true. But it was actually... the fun part, to be honest with you, was going back to those places, not fun in the things that happened, but in researching them again, the Entree Cafeteria, Scandia, the old world Los Angeles that no longer exists.
Right.
And
right.
There's a lot of nostalgia for that. There really is.
Right. Well, a lot of those buildings are gone and they've been torn down and rebuilt. And, it's just like... Yeah. It's just like, so much of old L.A. is gone. I mean, they tore down the Brown Derby. How do you tear down the Brown Derby?
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah. You know. I know. Just incredible landmarks.
Yeah, changes on Wilshire.
And then, of course, you mentioned the deli that had the turkey sandwiches.
Oh, Jurgensen's.
Absolutely.
On Larchmont, yes.
That turkey sandwich.
Yeah. Yeah, and he threw it away. Oh, I could have slapped you.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Bobby.
If I can just segue on that, I think for readers maybe that aren't familiar with those areas, I moved to the Pasadena area in 1991, so I had a lot of sort of learning to do about the area. But for readers, you give us so much detail mm-hmm. without making us feel like we're in a travelogue, or as we call sometimes a data dump, you know, between right. nail polish colors, lipstick colors, the fashions, what you were wearing to school, what you were wearing when you get into the high school and the outfit changes, what your mom was wearing. We see her home and her cars begin to deteriorate, but your mom doesn't. She's got it all together, recognizing that with no really skills, you know, if she needed to go work at Robinson's when it's not Rob May yet, it's still Robinson's,
right.
you know, or if she needed to find a job, and she really understands that she has to, she's very, you know, I have to find a new husband.
Right.
And
yeah,
you give us, you really put us right into the era, the music. When we get into the new blended family with Alan Stubbs and his kids, and they're listening to Jethro Tull, and you know, you take us through this whole 10, 15 years, whatever it turns 65 to wherever, you know, we end up in the 70s. And even if we didn't live through that, you take us there.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that right. part of it,
right.
and that you had such memory to be able to do that.
Right. We need to take a real quick break. Hang on to that thought, Heather. We need to take a real quick break. We'll be back with you. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block, and we will be right back with you after a short, brief message from LA Talk Radio.
Hi. Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. You know, it seems everyone has a podcast these days, so how about you do this? How about you start your very own radio show that goes out live worldwide for nary a pittance? If you think you have an idea that would translate to a radio talk format, then stop waiting. Go to www.latalkradio.com. Click on the link that says Become a Host. Follow the easy instructions, and before you know it, you'll be the on-air live host of your very own talk show on LA Talk Radio. We have 50-minute slots available every day, including Sundays, so don't be shy. Join the many that have started their careers on the air. Join the hosts on LA Talk Radio at www.latalkradio.com.
And we are back. And if you don't have anything to say, do a podcast. If you got something to say, go to LA Talk Radio and do it live. What the hell? Okay, we're back with our guest, Ms. Heather Haldeman. And if you want to call and talk to Heather this evening, and she is a wonderful, wonderful conversationalist, you can call her right here in the studio, 323-203-0815. And again, that number is 323-203-0815. Okay, Heather, I'm sorry I cut you off. You may continue.
Oh, that's all right. what I was saying about memory is that many people have asked me how I remembered everything, and how did you, you know, remember something that happened when you were 11 or 12? And actually, they say that when emotion is tied to a memory, it can be very keen. Your mind can be very keen, and I think that's how it happened for me, mm-hmm. that when I was, these are very emotional times, and I would, you know, it'd be very easy to remember it all. And again, setting scenes, once you set the scene, you're in it, and I found it very easy to do that, to remember. However, let me interject here. It's my mother. She passed away in 2018, but I read every chapter to her when I was writing this book. And she was, I would you know, call her up and say, "Hey, Mom, I have chapter 8. Are you ready?" And she was fabulous. She'd say, "Oh my God, it was that bad. Oh, it was hysterical. Actually, it was fabulous." But she helped me a lot with my memory. She'd say, "But remember this and remember that." I go, "Oh gosh, yes, that's right." So there was a little, I did help get some help from that. And then of course my sister, helped me out with, some of the more, you know, detail-y things, but that I did not really, really know.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding, like, for example, divorce and all that.
Yeah. You know, I think that when you go through such a devastating period as you did, it's the more devastated you are, the easier it is to remember the feelings that you had. And mm-hmm. I only say that because of personal knowledge. When I was 15, my mom and dad split up. They didn't get divorced. But my dad was like your dad. He owned a paint company and he found a girlfriend in San Diego and moved down there to be with her. And my mother had finally, after about 2 weeks of that, got fed up and sent us down there to get him. And we showed up and he wasn't there, but, the housekeeper said that we had showed up and next night he was home and, never left again. However, she showed up. I brought the two kids because she got married and went to Australia for a honeymoon. And my mother, God bless her, watched those two kids for 2 weeks while she was gone. To this day, I don't know how she did it. But I know the feelings that you went through because that's a time in my life when mm-hmm. It was devastating to me. So oh, I got that. You brought back those memories, actually. So I applaud you. If you can bring back memories like that to somebody, you've done your job.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome. Heather?
Yes. Well, the thing is that, again, that's why I always tell writers, anyone out there, everyone has a story. I feel like, as I said earlier, even though I'm not famous and, you know, I didn't have, you know, a famous drug situation or, you know, there was just, it was just a time and a period, but it was a story. And what I've learned through people reading it is like what you just said, Jim, is that they resonate on some level. Mm-hmm. There are so many divorced children. There are stepfathers who resonate or, heavy, you know, my neighbor around the block said, "Do you know, I used to be fat." I was, "Oh, okay." They, like you just shared, they share these feelings they went through as children of divorce or just a separation like you experienced. And right. It really, really devastates a child. It does. It's hard.
It really does. And, you know, especially back in the 60s where, you know, you never knew what was going on. It wasn't, I mean, exactly. Nowadays, people get divorced and they just, you know, I get the kids Tuesday, Thursday, you get them, you know, Monday, right. Wednesday, and Saturday, Sunday. And, you know, everything is so regimented. But back then, nobody mm-hmm. knew what was going on, you know.
No.
And my father and your father, too, tried to support two households with one income. And yeah. It didn't work then. And I'm sure it probably doesn't work now. So.
No.
But, you know, fortunately for me, you know, they stayed together. They were married for 61 years.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Yeah. I don't think they liked each other.
She hung in there. They had something.
Well, like I said, I don't think they liked each other the last 20, but, you know, at least they stuck together. They were just too lazy to get divorced, I think. But
wow.
Your story is like, okay, Rich, your story is like, it resonates with a lot of people, and I sincerely hope that enough people read this book that they can relate to what you went through and, mm-hmm. and bring their own story to it. So, yeah. You know, and okay. And Richard, you had something?
Well, I was just, you know, we're talking about how a lot of people would read this and it would resonate with them. And you mentioned in your book, Leedy, before we even got into the story, that some of the people you mentioned, you changed the names. So what I was curious about, did you give anybody a heads up? Hey, I'm doing this. This is what I'm talking about. Did you get any kind of feedback on that as far as, you know, please don't, or after they read it, did they come to you and say, hey, look, you got that right? Or I'm just kind of wondering what the reaction was when you told those people, you know, I'm not naming you, but people who know the story are going to figure out who this is.
Yes, that's a good question. Actually, I did not tell any of the people that I changed names that I was writing, that they were in the book. No one read my book other than my mother hearing me read it in my family until the ARCs were out. Uh-huh. And that anybody, ARC is the advanced review copies. And when you write a memoir, it is a very, very scary thing to do, because as I was writing it, I didn't think that. But once it was, you know, once I got my contract, actually, I thought, oh my gosh. But something propelled me to continue with this book. And my sister was amazing. She, of course, knew I was writing this, and she never asked to see any of it. And I said, come on, April, it's okay. Or, you know, are you sure? And I'd read her certain things. But she said no, and not no. I'll read it. And when I got the ARCs, I gave her a copy, and I was terrified, to be honest with you. And my sister is an amazing woman. She called me. She read it all night long and called me the next day. And she said, Heather, this is fabulous. And I cannot tell you how much that meant. That meant everything. I didn't care about anybody else. Of course, my cousin Jonathan, he had not read it either, and he mm-hmm. had the same reaction. I was worried about how I had portrayed his mother, and that was a concern. Now, Jonathan knew I was writing it, but both of them said, do it. And what my sister is an incredible hero to me, because she said to me that day after she read it, she said, if I had inserted myself into your story and told you, oh, no, no, that wasn't how it went, mm-hmm. You would have changed it. Because right. I was the stronger of the two, and I wanted you to have your story. I wanted you to tell your story. And that, what a gift. My God. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just love her so much. I mean, she has promoted this. She's amazing. And, you know, it brought her all back, and she was laughing about Bill Stubbs, our stepbrother, and how funny he was, or, you know, all the different things that we went through together. And how we've come out the other side, very, very close. And so to your point, they were the people I really cared about. I knew the McDougals are still very, you know, close to me. I adore them. They knew I was writing it, but there was nothing really I was writing about them that would be, you know, I would worry about. The Stubbs, I changed one of the names just because I felt I should. My stepbrother Bill was incredible, and John, they were incredible. They were lovely. They really supported me, supported the book, loved the book. A lot of the characters have passed away that I wrote about, but I thought if they have family, I just couldn't do that. And I think that you have to be very careful, but I will say this, and that is when I did get the ARCs that day, you know, you see the pictures of people all excited that, you know, their book's published and they open up the box. I was like having a panic attack because there it was all in print. I thought, oh my gosh, it's too late now. Here it is.
Yeah. So. Well, it's never too late. Never too late, Heather.
That's true.
If I ever write my memoirs, I'm not changing names. I'm just putting that out there right now. I'm letting it fly, and you guys just
takes what you get, sir.
Yep.
Okay. Let me guess. Let me guess which name you changed. Sarah.
Okay.
That would get my vote.
My mother had a few name changes for her too, but I won't say that.
I'm sure she did.
Oh my gosh.
Heather, the scene with the new blended family when you're all going to do chores on Saturday.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
My dad, every Saturday morning, we woke to either the 1812 Overture or John Philip Sousa or the Black Irish Band. And we got up and did chores. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Like, we did.
And that would have been in the 60s. That would have been that would have been
too.
Like 63 to 69 or something like that. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, my dad had a chocolate.
Like, my dad's not the only one that did that.
Yeah. As you finish your chore, you had to check it off on the chalkboard.
Yeah, we all had certain chores. But we knew it. I mean, we knew it. We didn't quite deal with what you did.
And then the Saturday afternoons, we had to sit in the living room with the stereo, one of the very first stereos they had, the big ones. And my dad used to put on symphonies. And he would sit there and have us name each instrument.
Oh my gosh. We were still doing chores.
We learned what bassoons sound like, and oboes and tubas and clarinets, bass clarinet. I mean, we learned them all. Viola, violin.
My gosh.
I couldn't tell you what they're today, but that's back then.
But as I hear you say that, is that, you know, how wonderful. Nowadays, they're all on their phones, you know, and then screens.
Yeah, we didn't have phones.
Yeah, no,
whereas you're learning, actually really learning something, but it was definitely a different time with the chores, I will say.
Yeah, oh, for sure. It was like, you know, mowing the lawn and edging and cleaning the garage. And
weeding and,
oh, my God. Oh, and picking up the dog poop. Yeah. That was always a big one.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that was Bill's job. Can't remember that one.
That was Bill's job, funny.
When is your favorite time to write? We've heard it all, so when is your favorite time to sit down and write? And
well, actually, my most productive time is after lunch. I find, I do what I've got to do in the morning, clean up and do chores or whatever, and then I would, especially during when I was writing the book, I would sit down at like 1:30. And even if I didn't have anything, I would force myself to sit in that chair until I got something out. And so I was really disciplined about it. It was like a job. And sometimes it would take like 2 hours to get something. And then I'd get a roll, like at 5:15.
Right.
And I got to make dinner. And, but I found that if I had a disciplined time, that I worked better, much better.
Okay. That's fair. Like, mine is in the morning, early morning.
Yeah.
Richard,
that's
I think
a lot of people. I find that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Because that's a long day. Sometimes I just get burned out or I get distracted. That's why I like to get everything done first, but nothing's ever really always done. But I do find for me, I just have to have a time and a place and a schedule.
Sure. Okay. Roberta.
Talking about writing, you've written a number of articles, published articles in magazines, as well as things like, Chicken Soup for the Soul. So when you were writing this book, were you on other writing projects at the same time?
Definitely. Actually, it took me a long time to write this book. And because when I would write essays and submit them, it was this fabulous quick fix. You beginning, middle, end, you submit, you get, it's exciting to get published. And it's not so daunting. I always hear people say, I need to write a book, or I'm going to write a book. And as you all know, it is so much work.
Oh, it is a lot of work.
And so writing an essay is a party. It's like, great, I'll write an essay. So, what happened was, I'll never forget it. I was on a plane with my daughter, Hillary, and I was showing her, it was chapter 6. I remember this. And she said, Mom, it's time to stop with the essays and finish your book. You really need to write this book. And I'll never forget it. And I thought, all right. And that's when I only wrote for one journal for a while, the Mom Megan, based in New York. And that that was the only thing I really did. I really had to focus. And then I kind of slowed down. You know, you get, it's so daunting. And then my husband and I were having dinner after my oldest got married. And I remember I was talking about the book and he said, Heather, you know what needs to do. You need to absolutely sit down and finish it. And having him say that to me, just like, you know what you need to do. It was just, it was like someone said, all right. And then I thought, okay. So I really put the pedal to the metal. Mm-hmm. I didn't start at 1:30. I think I started in the morning during that period. But I do enjoy writing essays. It's fun. It's not as hard at all as it is to write a book, as you all know. I continue to write them, but it's, I'm always on the hunt for a good one, you know, and what should I write about now? So.
Well, I have to say that your husband being who he is and it's as supportive as he has been with you, that had to have been a huge breath of fresh air for you to have that kind of support from someone that close in your life, not having had it before.
Yes, definitely. And it actually, my husband is, he's an amazing guy. He is he's supportive, but he's very helpful when I work. He will, you know, I'll read him something. He'll say, you need to fix that. And at first I would be mad at him. It's like, no, what do you mean? And now I love it. He has to read absolutely everything that I write. But he, when I was engaged, when I was engaged, I was worried. I was terrified to get married knowing that what had happened in my life. I mean, sure. Why would I do this? And I went to a psychiatrist, Dr. Ferguson, who's in the book. And I told him I was just really afraid to get married. And he said, can you trust Hank? And I said, yes. And he said, then there's your answer. And that's the truth. And so 42 years later, here we are. And, you know, I described him as being solid and all this. He said, gosh, you make me sound boring, Heather. I said, no, you're not boring. But for me, that is huge, is the solid guy who shows up, who's an incredible father and a great husband. I really won the lottery on this guy. And my mother adored him because he was, quote, sane. And, you know, it just... She goes, you're saying, you know, you're going to handle my estate. What estate? My God. It's been a good life together for us.
Yeah. It's amazing. Cause guys, the other night when Heather and I talked, when I called her, she answered the phone, but she was sitting in a restaurant in Park City, Utah. And as she moved to another table so she could have a conversation, and a waiter came up and said, can I help you with something? And she goes, no.
It was so funny. I was in the back. I didn't know where to go. So I went to this back room, and they had like a box of potatoes, and there were chairs everywhere. And they kept coming in. It's like, hi, I'm sorry. I'm on a work call. It was
really
funny, actually. I apologize. I
oh no!
To it, so unprofessional.
Not to me. I mean, to maybe to the waiter. But we're going to take another
look
real
on her
quick
face.
Break. Yeah, we're going to take another real quick break, and then we'll be right back with you because Bobby Jean is going to ask you the question. And
congratulations!
You are listening
you
to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block, and we'll be right back with you after this brief word from Black Dog Publishing and Tuscany Bay Books.
Congratulations, you finally finished that book. Now what are you going to do with it? Well, as a new writer, you probably do what all new writers do, stick it in the drawer with the other six or seven. Well, why not this time do something a little different? Why not get a hold of Black Dog Publishing and our fine imprint of Tuscany Bay Books? See, we can get that book out of the drawer. We can proofread it. We can edit it. We can format it. We can publish it. We can print it. We can copyright it. And we can get it on the shelf so your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, hell, even a person you don't know or two or three might want to buy a copy. It's all what it's about. And all of this for less than the cost of your firstborn. So why not give us a shot? BlackDogPublishing.co, TuscanyBayBooks.com, your answer to getting your book published, and right now we're probably the best at what we do in this industry. Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay Books.
And we're back. And, of course, Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay. We are a boutique publisher. So if you have a novel out there that you're wondering what to do with, give us a shout. You can go to us at TuscanyBayBooks.com, and it's got everything you need right there. Okay. Bobby Jean, I'm turning it over to you.
I'm going to turn it over to Richard because he hasn't been with us for a few
weeks. Oh, that's right.
So, Richard, ask the question.
Boy, take a couple of weeks off. Jeez. Okay, Heather. We need to ask you the most important question that any writer should be asked. Have you ever, ever in your life suffered from that terrible affliction called writer's block? And if you have, what in the world have you done to chase that thing off?
Boy, that is the big question, isn't it?
Oh.
Mm-hmm. What I do typically is I force myself. I sit in that chair and will not allow myself to get up unless I get something done, something. And even if it's not that good, I find that if I make myself just pause and sit there, and maybe it may take an hour or two, that I can get something out.
Yeah.
And it just, for me, that works. But I think writer's block is so hard, and it happens to absolutely every writer. And you feel like you'll never be able to write anything good again. At least I do. I feel like I'm sitting there. I think, well, that little fun stint is over. You know, I don't know if I'll ever be able to write again. And it does come back. It's absolutely amazing. It does. If you have the right story and you have the discipline and you just give yourself a little time and a pause, it helps.
I totally agree. In fact, personally, I call it writer's pause for that very reason. Very good. Very good friend of our show, Tosca Lee. She's been on a couple, two, three times now. And Tosca is one of those hoity-toity New York Times bestselling authors.
Oh.
No, she's really down to earth. She's a great gal.
Don't go picking on a former neighbor of mine.
We love Tosca. Her deal was she has a mantra. It's write drunk, edit sober.
Ooh.
And I think we've all lived up to that at one time or another.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Oh, that's great. What was that again? What was that line again? That's a good one.
Write drunk, edit drunk. Sober.
Excellent. Well, that'll do it.
Do we have time for one more quick question? I know we're running out of time.
Yeah, we are.
I was so interested, Heather, that at the beginning of every chapter you have a quote, I'm guessing a quote of your mom's. These must have been comments that you heard regularly. Did she help remind you of some of the things that she was said all the time, or how did you just, you know, sit down and write out as many as you could remember? How'd that come about?
Oh my gosh. Trust me. I have like 164. My mother had a line for everything. And way before I wrote the book, we even had a book made up of, my sister called it, my mother was Nana to the grandchildren, Nana-isms. And so I literally have, I think it's like 164. And I would, in the chapter, when I was writing the chapter, I'd go back on my list and go, okay, what relates to this chapter? And inevitably I would find one. And she just, they were spot on. And I really miss that, because I would tell her something and she'd have a clip, boom, and it would come out and it would be perfect. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of material of hers. She's, as I said, the gift that just keeps on giving the writer, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah. Truly. Well, what are you writing now, Heather, real quick?
I actually am not writing a book right now, and I need another project. I will. I've got a few ideas in my head, but okay. I'm not there yet. But thank you for asking. I'm always writing essays.
When you do have one, this one came out in June, right? June?
Yes.
This year. When you do have one, please contact the bookie. We'd love to have you back with us. Of course, you're always welcome to call and chat.
You've been fun tonight. You three, you are a party.
We try.
You're great.
We try.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Right. The name of your book is, of course, Kids and Cocktails Don't Mix, Heather Haldeman. You can get it at Amazon, all the online booksellers. You can go to our website and get a copy if you want. So make sure that you pick up a copy because it's really fun, a fun read, not a happy read, but it is a good read.
It's a good read.
And Heather, thank you so much for joining us. It's just been a hoot having you.
Thank you.
Truly our pleasure. And we don't say that often.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Oh, and no, it's been ours. And thank you again for joining us. You can hang out if you want. Next week, we have Roy Griffiths, a returner from May 31st of 2018. And his new book is The Thing from HRV11. I have not gotten into it yet, but it's a guy's Gird Your Loins. It's 411 pages.
Hey, I know Roy is my brother from another mother. It's 410 glorious pages.
I knew Richard sent us all a little comment today about getting ready to, you know, for next week. So
I'm ready to do next week's show right now. So
yeah, we're ready.
And for all you new writers out there, a word to the wise. If you're going to turn in a manuscript, be prepared to go to work, because once we get it back to you formatted, that's when your job starts. So before we even edit, it goes back to you for corrections. Okay, guys, thank you so much. I want to thank Sam Hassan, the owner of LA Talk Radio. Of course, Bobby Jean Bill for joining us again. Mr. Richard Polinelli for coming back from Texas. And the bookie, I can never say enough about the bookie. She keeps this show on the air and keeps it rolling. And yes, we do. I believe me, Bobby, I do it every night. So, and our guest again, Heather Haldeman, thank you so much for joining us. And
thank you.
For the rest of the people involved in this program, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for your hard work. And we are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.